I think we were petrol bombed 4 times. I guess I was shot at about a dozen times as a 10-year-old. That was quite a baptism of fire.
Hello and welcome to V for Visionaries podcast with me, Richard Ward. I am an award-winning serial entrepreneur with over 35 years experience in the beauty and media world. But today I'm most interested in finding out who are the movers and shakers in business, what makes them so successful, and why certain cream rises to the top.
And me, Rosamund Stenhouse. I am an award-winning fourth generation of entrepreneurs. I have spent several decades working with all aspects of land, delivering new towns and large-scale landmass for development. I now work with national and international entrepreneurs, scaling, improving sales, and expanding their business. This is the podcast where bold ideas meet business brilliance.
Yes, and each week we'll be sitting down with trailblazing entrepreneurs and industry leaders to uncover the strategies, the stories, and the secrets behind some of the world's most exciting business ventures.
And today we are so privileged and delighted to have Mike Tobin OBE, the no-nonsense maverick who revolutionized the data center industry, turning vision into empire. A trailblazing serial entrepreneur and sought-after speaker and author, he's redefining leadership with his bold, unapologetic flair.
So without further ado, welcome to V for Visionaries.
We are so excited today and so grateful to Michael Tobin OBE, and he is the founder and chairman of Tobin Ventures Limited. Mike is a serial tech entrepreneur with over 30 years experience in the telecoms and tech sector. In 2002, he joined Redbus as a sales and marketing director, and only 1 year later became the CEO, merging Redbus with Telecity. In just 4 years, he had managed the company to a successful IPO to become the leading data center in Europe. He is the author of several books, one being Lifting the Floor of the Data Center Industry, published in 2020. One of his peers described him as the most exceptional man he'd ever met. So, wow, there's so much to talk about. Welcome to V for Visionaries, Michael Tobin, OBE.
Thank you very much, guys. Pleasure to be here.
So, as we do on all podcasts, as all podcasters do, we like to take you straight and right back to where it all began. Where did you grow up, Mike? I'm seeing you speak so many languages. You speak Afrikaans. Does that tell me you're born in South Africa?
Well, actually, I was born in the East End of London.
Which
I never spoke Afrikaans there, but rough area. My father was in prison when I was born. He was in and out of prison regularly, part of a gang. My dad was quite violent to my mother regularly. And so when I was 7, she took an opportunity to escape. We left to Africa in the hope that he wouldn't find us. And we ended up in what was then called Rhodesia, now called Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
We didn't realize that actually we were going from sort of frying pan to fire, because the country was in the middle of a civil war. I think we were petrol bombed 4 times. A couple of them destroyed our house. Fortunately, we weren't there. I guess I was shot at about a dozen times. One got me in the leg. As a sub 10-year-old, that was quite a baptism of fire. But learned Afrikaans in school.
Sorry, can I just ask you, I'm intrigued. Why Rhodesia?
Well, yeah, that is a good, you know. So my mother was a shipping manageress in a company called British Rhodesian Steel. And she had the intention of going to Canada, which would have been a holy... better experience for a young lad. But what they'd set her up. They said, look, you come there, we'll get you accommodation, you've got a job straight away. And you know, for a single mom with a little boy going, emigrating in a rush, she felt that it was better to have support at the time. But that meant going
did
to
did she not have family? Did she not have sisters or
no one that would be in a position to help?
Wow. So where'd you go from there, Mike? Where'd you go from there?
I left school at 16.
Yes.
Was desperate to just get out and make money and do stuff.
Are you academically bright, Mike?
Not really. I mean, I would have got 51% in every exam.
Okay.
And one of the benefits of Africa, where you had a very strict upbringing, very strict schooling, you had to wear a uniform all the time. You had to tip your hat to the ladies as you walked through.
Yeah,
otherwise, you'd get whipped. And one of the things you had was a tie, and I could write all the answers down to the exam questions and roll it up and put it inside my tie. So that during the exam, I had all the questions available to me and that's how I'd get 51% in every exam. So no, not really academically gifted, but was able to, I guess I had a bit of the gift of the gab, if you put it that way.
I just want to ask one quick question, just dash back a second. What happened to your mother?
She actually was chased by my father, in Africa and subsequently. So he actually came out and found us in Africa. The funny story, because she sent an image of a picture of me in the garden of the block of flats that we were staying at in Salisbury, and through a number of different family members so that it wouldn't be traced. And he came out, he bribed the immigration people to find out which country we'd gone to. And he hired a helicopter and flew around Salisbury until he saw the background of the image and found us. Tried to kill my mum again, got deported, and then got a disguise and a fake passport, came back again, and chased us up into the hills of a place called Umtali, which is on the east side of Rhodesia, connecting with Mozambique, and found us again, but eventually got deported again. So yeah, she was constantly being chased by him.
What was that all about, Mike? What was that? This is control, isn't it? This isn't love, is it? What is it?
It's control.
Control, yeah, it is. And you know, the embarrassment of being left as well, I guess, from his point
Pride,
of view.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, it was an insult, I guess, to an extent.
Let me ask you something, Mike. When growing up, because we all sort of think, I always think I'm like my father. Was there a part of you that feared anything in you, anything being like that man?
Yeah, absolutely. And probably progressively in later days, you know, later times, you look at yourself, you criticize your attitudes and thoughts with that in the back of your mind.
How many years with that in mind, I'm just going to make a blank statement, do you think you lived in survival mode?
Well, I'm 60 now, so probably about 55 of them.
I thought you were going to say that.
Yeah.
So let's take you to 20 and you finish your apprenticeship. And so what are you by trade at that time? You are what? An engineer, are you? A tech engineer? Or
yeah, electrical, electronic engineer.
Right.
So I could wire a house. It was a great background to have in terms of, you know, a technical view of life. And this goes right through to sort of plumbers and everyone else. When they come to your house and there's a leak, there's a certain process of elimination that they do, right? So point one is switch off the stopcock, right? Point two is, you know, measure between there and there. Where's the pressure gone? You know, and through a process of elimination, you find the fault.
Huh.
And then when you get the fault, you fix it. And this sort of way of thinking, this way of approaching challenges or issues.
Well, it's very logical, isn't it?
It's extremely logical, yeah. Now I sort of approach an issue, approach challenge in a very sort of structured way. And by breaking it down, nothing seems particularly big or important.
Mike, I'm going to jump a second. Yeah. There was something, the book, Forget Strategy, Get Results. And immediately my head says, but everyone teaches you to strategize. The reason I want to bring that up is just because of what you said. And I'm looking at you and I'm listening. And one of the things that was said about or was written was that your management style was radical extreme. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think that probably is. I think there's a, you know, historically we used to think about, you know, if you're trying to deliver a solution and deliver a product, it had to be perfect before it was put out there. But over the last 20 years, in particular, the likes of Microsoft would bring out a new version. So back in the day, there would be, Windows 1, Windows 2, Windows 3. But now no one even knows what version we have because it just gets updated overnight. So actually, they're putting it out there and it's not perfect. And there's a bug fix every couple of days. But we take that, we accept it because it's so much, it's so advanced versus the last version, right? that we'll take it incomplete or imperfect because it's progress.
Yes. Right?
So you know, you'll never be the best at anything. You'll never be probably the worst at anything. But you know, for me, success is not a destination. It's a journey. Mm. So you're constantly simply looking for something better than yesterday.
So why would the management style be stated as extreme?
I tend to sort of think about leadership rather than management for a start, because
okay.
I think if you have to manage people, you've probably got the wrong people, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when I recruit, I don't necessarily recruit skills. I recruit attitude.
I mean, you probably employ many more people than me, but I've got 105 that work with me. And that's exactly what I look for. Because you can mold the rest, can't you? With a positive attitude.
Training is relatively easy once you've got the right attitude.
Yeah. Sorry, I just want to hear about the entrepreneur of Mike Tobin. So you are what? Then you're an engineer and you start working for a company. At what point do you then start thinking of going it alone? And what niches and things did and gaps in the market did you see? And how old were you?
Well, I guess a big break. So when I was like 21, I applied for a technical director role for a French computer company in London, and I got the job. But it was because they weren't selling anything, and it was just a token that they had this UK subsidiary of the French company. No one paid it any attention. Then there was a CEO, a sales director, and then basically me. And so brilliant. I was sitting there with nothing to fix, with a title that was, you know, way above my station, but nobody cared because there was nothing. And then, so I just opened the Yellow Pages. It was back in the day before Google, right? And so you pick up Yellow Pages, flicking through. And I was just looking for companies that were computer distributors. And I found one that was in Wales, in a place called Baglan, which is in South Wales. And they were a BBC Commodore distributor. And so I phoned them up and said, look, we've got these great new computers. We're looking for distributors. And they went, fine, come and see me. Now, I wasn't a salesman, but I just took it upon myself because I was bored not being able to do anything technical to do something that would perhaps change the company. And bizarrely, they placed their first order for a couple of hundred machines. France went crazy because they didn't have any British keyboards ready because they didn't expect anyone to sell any computers in the UK. So my name was in lights, and at that point, the then CEO had a heart attack, and whilst he survived, he couldn't carry on. And the French didn't really want to go through a recruitment process. So they said, well, this guy seems to know something. Do you want to be CEO, right? So, and at the age of 21 and three quarters or whatever, I was CEO.
That takes balls to say yes.
This wasn't, isn't Redbus, is it? This isn't.
No, this is before.
Redbus was later, Yeah.
So that's, and then I moved to France with that company.
Yeah.
Because they asked me to set up their Scandinavian subsidiary. I'd never been to Scandinavia, but I spoke English, which was better than what they did in France, right? And so they thought that I was more likely to set up in Scandinavia than they were. So it was a very bizarre thing. Anyway, I ended up staying in France for sort of 13, 14 years. Learned French and started setting up international businesses around the world, and then got a role with ICL back in the day. ICL was kind of a British IBM, to change their company, or to kind of bring it out of the doldrums in Denmark. And so I moved to Denmark. So my eldest daughter was born in Denmark, was there for a few years, and then transform that business. And they said, could you set up the e-business operations of the company in Frankfurt? So I went to Frankfurt for a few years. My son was born in Frankfurt. And then in 2001, at the dot-com bubble bursting, I had a one-month-old son and a three-year-old daughter. And the world was, you know, the tech world was falling apart around us. So
I was in Silicon Valley at the time. I literally was there on the phone to guys going, you know, the VP of VP of VP with the billion shares. I've just lost everything, you know, crazy.
Yeah, exactly. So share prices went from sort of 10 to the zero.
Zero, yeah.
And then I said, well, let's go back to the UK. Let's hunker down. And I've probably got a better chance of, you know, stability at that point.
Yeah.
And I didn't do any due diligence, but I came across this company called Redbus. and became sales director there.
What was that, Mike? What was that?
So it was a data center company, but it listed on the London Exchange for about 400 million, spent all the money. The fact that I didn't do the DD, the market cap was 6 million now, but it was burning 2.5 million a month. So I had basically 2.5 paydays. And so I walked into the board meeting. I'd only been there 2 weeks and I gate crashed the board meeting. I said, I'm really sorry, but I don't know. Yeah, you're a listed company and someone should be like putting public announcements out here saying how bad this is, right? And there was a big boardroom bust up and then I was then put in as CEO. Probably it's saying I was going to be a fall guy. And then I took it private. And again, there's a lot of luck in all this, right? So, I'd just become CEO. We had about a month's pay left. It was before Christmas. It was one of the hardest things I had to do. I took about 150 people down to about 40.
Yeah.
2 weeks before Christmas.
Yeah.
And I said, look, I've got two things here. Either I can do it after Christmas and you have a nice Christmas, but you'll probably, borrow more money to buy presents and things like that. And then you're going to lose your job.
Yeah.
Or I can give you 1 month extra money now and make you redundant before Christmas, but at least you can tighten your belt and you have a month of extra money, right? So took that decision. I was sort of spat at by half the people and swore at. But that was the thing. And I had to focus on the 40 people that were left.
Yep.
Right? And that was the kind of channeling the thought was, I've saved 40 jobs rather than I've made 100 people redundant 2 weeks before
Christmas. Mike, one thing that really intrigues me there is, how do you decide who out of that 140, how do you decide the 100 to make redundant in such a short space of time?
So one of the things, so in those days, the legal requirements of going into consultancy and everything else didn't apply. And especially if you took out swathes of the same people. So where it's challenging, right, is if, let's say you have 10 salespeople and you want to go to two salespeople. Today you have to go through a consultancy process and put them all at risk and then come up with some criteria, which is independent of who those individuals are, to then say, okay, you're the 8 are leaving and you're the 2 that are staying. If you take out all 10, you don't need to do that because effectively there's no criteria required. You're removing the entire sales.
Yeah.
So one of the things was, other than the essential engineers that were keeping the lights on in the morning, everyone went.
So did you feel in your heart of hearts you could turn that around, in given that you only had 2 months wages money left?
I don't know. I just don't know. But I'll tell you what happened, right? So I did the kind of things like this.
Yeah.
It still wouldn't have been enough. But a week later, I was out in Prague. We just literally, it was the opening of our Prague data center and we had the British ambassador at the opening. And all I was thinking is, this is another increase of burn rate because I had to keep the lights on. And within 3 days of opening, they had the great floods of Prague and the entire building flooded, right? Unbelievable flood. Meters and meters. And we had it insured for about £45 million.
Fantastic.
I went to the insurer. I literally walked into his door and I said, I'm going to cut you a deal. Give me £8 million now, right? But it needs to be now, right?
Brilliant.
And we'll call it a day.
Brilliant.
Right? And he did that because it's in his interest as well. He gave me £8 million. And that £8 million kicked the can down the road for me to find a couple of other investors to allow us to take the business private, delist it.
Yes.
And then we got, we merged with another company with almost similar situation called Telecity. We adopted the Telecity name because it was more synonymous with data centers than Redbus was. And then we basically survived hand to mouth until we were able to relist it in 07 for $200 million. And then we sold it in 2014 for $3.5 million.
But Mike, what's so amazing listening to you is so many people choke in that space of adrenaline, when the anxiety mixes with the adrenaline, when someone says to you, can you do this title? Can you do this role? Going into the board and saying, look, you guys, this is, I mean, they obviously weren't regulated, but even if they were, they sound like they would have done it. But you need to change this and actually turn around and say, yes, I have the balls to step up and I'll take the CEO role and front the entire wrath of whatever was coming. Most people choke.
I guess the thing is, right, that Again, it's breaking things down into small pieces. And, you know, no one's going to kill you. No one's going to, you know, the worst thing is that you're going to be slightly financially worse off than before. But if you can give something a shot, then maybe you can pull it off. But it's like when I did my 40 marathons in 40 days for the Prince's Trust, right? So every morning, waking up and doing 26 miles before I started work, right? So I'd finish in the company that sponsored me that day and did a keynote speech at 9 a.m. and then come home, get an ice bath and do my day job. And people were saying, how did you do it? Well, 26 miles, 42 kilometers is 42,000 steps. So it's simply just putting one foot in front of the other 42,000 times and you're done.
No.
So thinking about a challenge like that and being overwhelmed doesn't get you anywhere. But if you just start breaking it down, say, okay, what can I do right now? What can I literally do now to change, to improve? So I try to tell people there's a principle of every scenario you come to in life, everything, personal, business. If you don't like something, right, you've got three options, in my opinion. Status quo is not acceptable because you're wasting your life if you're putting up with something you don't like, right? But if you can apply the three principles of love it, leave it, or change it, right, then you can move on quickly. So you say, okay, I can learn to truly, I'm going to change my opinion. I'm going to love this thing rather than dislike it. But you've got to mentally believe that, not pretend. So if you can't do that, right, can you change it? Right? Can you modify the situation so that you can love it? Right? And if you can't do that, walk away.
It's very simple. And even that advice is broken down into very simple. You've compartmentalized that. I mean, I'm sitting there hanging on your every word.
So me too.
You know,
I'm learning.
You know, my mind, I've left the podcast and I'm thinking, how can I apply this to my business?
Scenarios.
Absolutely. It's brilliant.
So it's the concept as well that I talk about in a couple of books where, you know, the fear of failure is the most irrational emotion we have, right? Because it, you know, we don't fear the past because it's done. We rarely fear the present because we're going through it, we're dealing with it. And we always fear the future and we add a quotient of fear over and above the likelihood of that happening to the future, right? It's rarely as bad as we perceive it will be. It's like paying interest on a mortgage you haven't yet drawn down.
Absolutely.
Right? Training you of everything.
100%.
So when you think about the future, you say, okay, so is it inevitable? In which case, don't worry about it, right? If it isn't inevitable, what things can you do to mitigate it happening, right?
Yes.
Then do them.
Yes.
Right? And if there's nothing to do, there's nothing to do. Don't worry about it, right?
Yeah.
And so having that approach at least gives you the best quality of the present that you can have.
That's what I was just thinking. You have learned how to be present. You're describing a person who is comfortable with being totally and utterly present. And a lot of people don't want to feel that.
Look, there's people, spend, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds talking to a shrink to tell them just that. Basically,
you know, Michael, I mean, Tobin,
you know, it's but what I but you know, and this is what I tell you what I've just turned 58, just I might add, last week.
Don't look it.
It cost a lot of money, Mike. Cost a lot of money. I have this conversation with Roz. That's what I always struggle with, to be present. But my argument is sometimes the fact I am the worst offender of what you're talking about, thinking too much to the future. But in some ways, I will also counteract that argument. That has actually been the very thing that's actually helped me to be successful, because I'm always looking down the road.
Well, I would suggest an explanation of that, which I subscribe to. So the whole point of forget strategy, get results is actually a bit tongue-in-cheek, because I replace strategy with vision. Okay, so what do you want to be famous for sometime over there? So you have a destination, you know, that's your direction. Okay, now we don't know what's going to. So Jean-Paul Sartre says something really funny about soccer, right? Football. He says, in football, everything is complicated by the presence of the opposite team,
right?
So you can have your strategy, you can draw the little thing around there and do this, but you don't tell the other side, so they're going to mess it up for you, right? So, but you still, you know, your vision is I'm going to win the game, right? But the way you get there cannot always, and very rarely these days, can be premeditated to the nth degree. Are you guys going on vacation anytime soon?
Yeah, probably. We're going a few days away.
Yes.
Okay, so fine. So you know where you're going. You might have booked a hotel. You don't know which room you're going to be in, probably. You if you're going by cab, you don't know which route the
car is. If it's anything like Richard, we'll be given the room and then the room will change several times.
even more to my point, right? So, you know, you wonder which route the cab will take. If there's an accident on the road, that's not the end of your holiday. Your holiday vision is still you're going to do it. So it might take a different route around, right? And you may have to like maybe get a train instead if it's worst case scenario, but you're still going to have your holiday, right? So you have the vision, right? And what I would suggest, Richard, is you have a clear vision of where you want to be, but your tactics and your plans can shift and allow them to shift, right? If you're a Sailors do this all the time. You know, the vision for us, for the sailor, is I'm sailing to Calais in the morning to have a nice sole meunier in France. And wakes up in the morning and the wind is blowing exactly against him. Well, he says, well, you know what? My vision is still the same. I'll have to tack a few more times.
Yeah.
I'm still going to where I need to be, right? So the plan changes, but the vision stays the same.
Can I suggest something to you, Mike? There will be people listening to this saying, oh, that's so good. Oh, I really want to implement it. The problem with implementing this way of thinking and this way of being, because you've got to be comfortable with your present self. You have to be comfortable with you, is a lot of people like the idea, but they don't actually like the feeling. I think a lot of people like feeling off, worried, negative. You're describing a very daily decision to have a very positive outcome in everything.
Yeah, I think, look, if you looked at my diary, I have board meetings going through to the end of 2025 in there already. It's fully loaded. So it's not like I don't plan, right? But I'm also comfortable with plans changing.
Mm. Yeah.
Flexibility, right, is what keeps success kind of within sight. And the rate of change in our lives is getting faster. The rate of change is speeding up.
Yes. Okay? Oh,
which
yes.
means that our ability to predict the future is coming under ever more scrutiny and question because of change. And technology is driving that. All sorts of things are driving that. But, you know, and now with AI, which will be infinitely better than us at predicting and analyzing the future, right? We will have to be second to life in terms of how we think about things. You know, I saw this great advert once, right? And one of these typical adverts where, you know, you remember the advert, but you can't remember what it was advertising. Mm. You know? Yeah.
Regularly.
It was a picture in a magazine and it had a heart monitor with the heartbeat doing this, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it said underneath, if you're not experiencing the ups and downs, you're dead, because it would be flatline.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
True.
So having the ups and downs are what gives you the buzz, right? And you can have very, very wealthy people that have no material kind of excitement in their life because being wealthy isn't enough.
Yeah.
You have people that don't have much wealth but have a lot of fun, and they're like this all the time, right? So delta between the highs and lows that gives you the buzz. So one of the guys that taught me to sell back in that French computer company, so the sales director then, so remember those three of us, the CEO that got the heart attack, it was me and the sales director. The sales director was a guy called Ian Watson. He was Brian Adams's cousin, right? So that's a story for another day as well.
No way. Crazy. Whenever
Brian Adams used to come around, we used to go and see backstage and play darts with him. But he said, look, Here's a great lesson about sales. Imagine you're a broom salesman, okay? And you've been it's a family company. You've been a broom salesman. Your family sold brooms for 100 years. You've got all the stats of who buys brooms, how many is likely to buy brooms. So you come across this Victorian terrace house row of 100 houses, and you know, because you've been selling brooms for 100 years, 98 of those houses are going to have a broom. That's the stats say they're going to have a broom. One of those houses won't have a broom but can't afford yours, and one of them won't have a broom and will buy yours. So that's your stats. Then you come along and you knock on the first door, bang, 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 like that. Hello, how are you doing? Hello, I've got a book. Slam. How do you feel with a door being slammed in your face? Not rejection, right? Because I know I'm going to have to go through that. So I've just got to get through them quickly. And when you think about challenges in life, and this is what I tell my teams, is like, embrace issues, embrace challenges, because if it was easy, everyone would be doing it, right? And the more challenges you encounter, it's like the reason they put hurdles in a hurdle race is to make sure that you've got to get over it, right? And if every now and again, one doesn't get over it. Even the fast ones, sometimes they hit the hurdle, they're done. And every time you overcome a hurdle, you're putting a gap between you and your competition.
Yes.
You should look for challenges, because it's highly unlikely that you're the only people in your sector, in your industry, that are going to see those challenges.
Yeah.
Yes. Right?
Everyone's going to see the same challenges. So the quicker you get over them, the bigger the gap is between you and your competition. So search them out, embrace them, fix it, and put that gap between you and everyone else.
100%. Yeah. Mike, I'm just looking at this notes, which I've got screaming out of me in red. NHS responder. What the bloody hell is, well, I know what that is, and how on earth have you got time for that?
No, well, I mean, look, it was primarily during lockdown, right? And again, everyone had a lot more time on their hands, and it was more about the simple stuff. So you could go around your neighbors, make sure they're okay, knock on their door, stand 3 feet away and say, you know, is everything okay? Do you need a 10-minute chat? Can I get you some shopping? You know, just little things, just little stuff that, you know, anybody can do. You know, you don't even need to know how to do resuscitation or anything like that. It's just engage with humans. And because in lockdown, people weren't going out, you know, especially elderly people were suffering from lack of exposure to humans, right? And so having someone just knock on the door, stand back and say, how's it going?
Yeah.
You know, what are you up to? Do you have a leaky tap that you want someone to fix? Or do you do you like the weather? It doesn't matter. Having an engagement and then saying, you know, can I help you with shopping? Do you have some, you know, can you get to the pharmacy? Are your prescriptions running short? You know, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
So that kind of concept of first responder, you know, it's something that really came to the fore in during COVID, where you can just be slightly more social to your neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah. Also, the families are so broken up in the UK now that you see old people in the street and you wonder to yourself, how many people have they spoken to today? And I always say hello. I say hello to everyone. He's told me to stop that, but I do say hello.
It's probably something we don't do enough of in London, actually, relative to other parts of the UK.
Well, that's why. He's a Londoner. Mike, we've got about 5 to 10 minutes left, and I can't thank you enough, because I feel, I was grinning like a Cheshire cat most of the time you're speaking, because you're just such a wonderful energy.
Thanks.
You're such a light man. And I'm looking at you. Your haircut is very trendy. It is trendy.
It's a bit like a sort of a Tintin.
Yeah, it's like a bobber boy back. Do you remember Camden Town with the winkle pickers? And the hair, you got a bit of that going on. So I want to, and you've got a necklace on, you've got bracelets. Yeah,
I see Elvis behind you.
Yeah, he does all that. But I just want to ask what kind of music you like, or who is your music idol?
Well, I like all sorts of music. At various parties, we've had everyone from Kid Creole and the Coconuts to Boy George at our parties. We love everything in between. So when my wife Shalina and I got married, just before the wedding, I took her to, we had a bit of a debate over who could dance the best. And clearly I was punching above my weight in all sorts of categories. So we went to Argentina and learnt to tango.
No.
Brilliant.
Tango teachers in the world. And then we went to Rio to learn samba and salsa.
That's fantastic.
Of course, is there anything you haven't done?
No, I'll
tell you the other thing, because I'll forget. I've got to ask you, on your LinkedIn profile, you look like you're up Everest. Tell me.
Yeah, so when that was 2020, I trekked to the South Pole to raise money for children with brain tumors. We raised a couple of £1 million, but that was more brutal than the marathons. That was minus 67 degrees. 3 weeks dragging 150 kilos behind you on a sledge.
Yes, I'm sure.
Absolutely. I didn't have feeling in my fingers for about 9 months afterwards. And it was very, very...
That was close.
Every morning was like literally just, you know, everything was just frozen on your face.
I can imagine. So this is a harder question. If you were prime minister today, what would be the first thing that you would do?
Well, there'd be 100 things, but I think we are too scared to make very tough decisions in leadership. And what I would do is I would bring income tax down to virtually zero, and I would put VAT through the roof, but on variable items. So at the moment, right, if you buy an orange today, you don't pay VAT, but if you buy orange juice, you do, okay? So if you think about putting the VAT up on rubbish foods and sugars and all those things, you would instantly change the dietary habits of people that were watching the pennies, right? Right now, the worst food, the McDonald's and everything else, is the cheapest food you can buy. So you're driving people on at the lower end of the scale to eat badly and therefore become obese and therefore to become a burden on the NHS and so on and so forth. So changing behavior. And again, if you buy a Mini to get to work, right, you pay low VAT. And if you buy a Rolls Royce, you pay very high VAT. So if someone wants to spend their income on VIP luxury, so be it. Great. It's still generating jobs. And there's lots of money coming back into the thing, right? But it can't be a burden on someone that needs a car for an essential use to get to work.
Mike, I know I don't even need to talk to Roz. We have so enjoyed this podcast. Look, we just want to thank you so, so much. And I know all our listeners and viewers will take so much from this. So thank you so much, Mike Tobin. One thing, where can people find you if you want them to find you, social media-wise?
Yeah, I do a regular building my own beef burgers at home on Instagram. So they'll find that there. MichaelTobin.online is a webpage that has some of my stuff on it. But you know, the books are all on Amazon. There's all, you can find me anywhere, really.
Mike Tobin, OBE, thank you so, so much.
Pleasure.
Thanks once again to Mike Tobin, OBE, of Tobin Ventures Limited. And even bigger thanks to you for listening to this episode of V for Visionaries podcast.
We would love it if you could take a moment to subscribe and hit 5 stars. And we will see you in the next episode.